I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, the show for curious cooks and eaters. Bread definitely has its obsessives, right? People who geek out over hydration percentages and proofing times to the millisecond. But for most people, bread is just the thing that's there. It's your daily bread, right? It's inevitable and invisible. And most of the time, it's nothing special. But like all things, even the nothing special, everyday version of something can be fascinating. Look at injera, the chewy, sour, bubbly bread of Ethiopia that's so much the center of the meal that people use it as a utensil, a plate, and a seasoning. We'll get a lesson on making it later in the show. We're also going to get into the history of why New York bagels aren't really what they're cracked up to be anymore. We'll learn why breads get flatter as you go further north in the Nordic countries, and America's Test Kitchen comes in with, well, the ultimate nothing special bread, white bread. But first, biscuits. Next to cornbread, there's probably no American bread tradition that inspires more passion than biscuits. They have this mystique, right? I mean, when you talk to biscuit people, it's like there's the door code to the Illuminati meeting room, and then there's the secret to how Mama makes her biscuits. But Erica Council is a software engineer in Atlanta who, several chefs have told me, is the best biscuit maker in the land, and she is unimpressed with all the pomp around making biscuits. It's not to say that she doesn't take them seriously, though, because she really does. And she joins me here today. Erica Council, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me, Francis. How's it going?
I would be better with a biscuit in front of me, but I guess we'll just talk about it and imagine.
I would be too.
So I've been told that you make the greatest biscuits of all time. And wow. So I want to talk to you about so many things. But first, let's start with your ideal biscuit itself, because there are, you know, a million styles of biscuit, right?
Yeah.
But to you, what is a great biscuit like?
For me personally, I like a biscuit that's sturdy. So, you know, one that's kind of crisp at the bottom and, yes, you know, even though it flakes in the center, it won't fall apart when I bite into it. Mm-hmm. So when I bite into that biscuit, I want to pull it away from my mouth and it just still be intact with my teeth marks in it.
Mm-hmm.
you know, but that biscuit to hold up to the gravy and don't fall apart, and more so a sausage and a runny egg or country ham can kind of, you know, a biscuit can withstand that.
Mm-hmm.
And not crumble to pieces, you know, more sturdy than a softer biscuit.
Mm-hmm. But still light, like still like have a good fluff,
yeah,
to it.
Yeah, still light. Yeah, I think the word I'm looking for is not crumbly.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be soft and light, but still sturdy.
Yeah. So here's like the literal million-dollar question. How do you make a biscuit like that? Like, I don't need to get your recipe necessarily, but you're an engineer, so I figure you've got all the steps like figured out. So what are techniques that you use to make a biscuit flaky, crisp on the bottom, but still have like enough body?
Well, I do know for the crispness on the bottom of the biscuit, I kind of do my, at home,
mm-hmm,
we'll do my cast iron skillet the way I do to make cornbread.
Mm.
And it's really how I learned how to make, you know, biscuits anyway. So with cornbread, you melt the butter in the cast iron skillet, and then you kind of add some sugar to the bottom of it.
Oh, wow.
And then when you pour in your cornbread, you put that in the oven, let it get hot. And then once you've mixed the cornbread mix, you put that into the, right in the skillet with the crisp butter and, you know, sparkling sugar. So once you've baked it and you take that cornbread out, it's got the sugar crust, which is the best thing in the world. So,
girl,
I just sort of adapted that same methodology to the biscuits at home. I let my pan warm up without the sugar and butter, but I let my pan get hot,
uh-huh,
in the oven. And then once I put the biscuit rounds on there, they actually don't take that long to cook because they're crisp at the bottom.
Mm.
And I make sure that the biscuits are not touching so that it's kind of crisp all around, because, you know, the biscuits are touching that touching side. It makes it soft,
mm,
versus having it crisp all around. And then I like to use an all-purpose flour. I have noticed that if you use King Arthur or Gold Medal versus the traditional White Lily, you hear all the Southerners talk about it, it does make a firmer biscuit.
Mm.
I do make them with the cake flour, all-purpose flour mixture, but those tend to be the more delicate biscuits for like shortcakes or things of that nature. I tend to stay away from that particular type of recipe that utilizes the fancier flours, as my grandma would say, when I want to make a sturdy biscuit. I remember her telling me one time I had some cake flour in my house, and she said, "What are you going to do with this?" I said, I use it to make cakes. She was like, "You know, cake flour and make a cake?" She said, "That's what's wrong with y'all young folks. You got to have special stuff to make stuff nowadays."
I can hear that look.
Yeah, it was so sassy.
I definitely want to get to your grandmother's in a moment, but I want to keep getting on this.
Yeah,
biscuit. Because
yeah.
the other question I always have with biscuit making is the butter, right? How do you treat the butter? How do you incorporate the butter?
Well, I cut my butter into like a half inch square to break it down, and then I'll cut it into the flour mix using a food processor. I'm making a big batch, if I'm making a small batch, I tend to use a pastry cutter or, you know, fork or something to cut it in, because my body temperature is so hot, so it melts the butter. But I was taught to throw the butter in there and toss it in the flour and then, like, you know, snap your fingers. So take the butter and, like, kind of snap it into the flour to get that, you know, crumbliness. But my snapping turns into melted butter, so I try to keep my hands out of the flour.
Yeah. So in the food processor, how much do you want the butter cut into the flour typically?
Just, you know, it's through trial and error that you learn. You know, I've kind of got it down to where I can notice it's kind of crumbling, I don't know, a little bit more than pie crust, in my opinion. You want to incorporate it into the flour, but you still want it to, you know, sort of see some of that butter, you know, so that steam will help get that kind of flakiness that comes from the butter, you know, separating in that dough. So,
and then you mix in some buttermilk, and that's your dough, right?
I mix in some buttermilk. Yeah, I like thick, whole, fatty buttermilk. Cruz Dairy Farm out of Tennessee is just the Beyonce of buttermilk. I mean, it just really reigns supreme amongst all others, and it's so hard to get. Like, I'll drive to Chattanooga to go get, you know, like a half a gallon and just go in Whole Foods and buy it all. And I know when they see me coming in there, they're probably like, "Lord, here she comes." So yeah, it's great, you know, but all buttermilk is not created equal.
So just a nice thick buttermilk and a little mix, very light with the hand.
Toss it together just to bring it together. And then, you know, my mixture sort of looks like a jumbled mess when I throw it onto the floured surface, where I'm just going to sort of pat it into a square. It kind of looks like, you know, it does look like it's falling apart and it won't work, but it does. And then I sort of take the flour bench scraper and just sort of, you know, to avoid my hands getting into it, and just kind of just put it into a square and like pat it down and fold it over a couple of times. Not much though. And then I'll just kind of cut it in threes and stack each layer on top of each other and roll it out and cut, you know, rounds or cut it into squares.
And bake away.
And bake it in the oven. Yeah.
And let me ask you, you brought up your grandmother before. You mentioned you started making biscuits because of both your grandmothers. Tell me about them.
Yeah, so my more well-known grandmother was Mildred Council, Mama Dip, Council of the Dip's Country Kitchen. It's a, you know, soul food, country, you know, she's from a different generation would refer to herself as the country cook, which I always love to hear her say, but it's kind of your typical meat and three. You get a basket of biscuits and cornbread, so I, you know, always had lots of exposure to the mass production of biscuits and how to cut corners to make lots. But on my maternal side, my grandmother on that side was very much into the civil rights movement. And, you know, growing up as a child, every lesson in foods tend to stem around, you know, liberation and black joy and all kinds of things. And she sort of taught me a lot of her story through food. And one in particular was she had an opportunity to go to Columbia University to get an advanced degree in education, and she took the opportunity. It's, you know, not without going into too much detail, there was, you know, back when there was segregation, you know, black educators were, you know, sort of in this position of, we want to get advanced degrees, we want to be able to advance our careers and take the knowledge back to our communities, but there weren't a lot of schools offering that. And so to mm-hmm. placate them, they sort of said, oh, well, Columbia has teamed up to sort of give you this program that can allow African-Americans from the South, you know, to go and take get advanced degrees from Columbia, thinking that no one would be able to get enough money to go up there, you know, and really take part. But I think a good 400 to 500 African-Americans actually ended up taking part in that program over a decade or so, a couple of decades. I might be wrong with that statistic, but I do remember that much. But her story was, you know, she was in New York. They went into some restaurant or whatever, and she just was so amazed at how, you know, white folk would just come up and talk to them, and as though it wasn't, you know, not an issue, you know, coming from the Jim Crow South. And, and they kind of ordered these, you know, meal, and it came with this basket of, you know, she called them biscuit rolls. And she said there was this other couple kind of sat next to them and just was asking them all these questions, and they started eating together. And it's just, for some reason, that story just kind of stuck with me. And I think she could tell how much it affected me. And that lesson just sort of triggered so many around food, you know, cakes she made to raise money to go hear MLK speak, and booths they set up to talk about voter rights. And they had, you know, pimento cheese sandwiches, you know, stuff like that. So
yeah,
the biscuits is kind of powerful on both sides, I think, because, you know, even now with a lot of the events that I'll have, if I'm able to raise money, it goes towards this program that I do where I sort of teach underrepresented kids how to do computer programming and just sort of ways of expanding your knowledge in case college isn't the route that you go, or you're unable to get to this certain stage, and, you know, how you can take the technical route to get where you need to be, just sort of taking in that whole, use this food and these opportunities to liberate your people as much as possible.
Thank you so much, Erica. Great talking with you.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Erica Council is a software engineer, writer, photographer, and runs the Bomb Biscuits pop-up in Atlanta. And she wanted you to have her recipe for biscuits and syrup butter. Get it at splendidtable.org. Coming up next, we find out what you can learn about a place by seeing what kind of bread they eat. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. This is The Splendid Table, a show for curious cooks and eaters, and I'm your host, Francis Lamb. You ever play one of those video games where you get to create your own character, right? And you're like, okay, I want 99 points for speed for sure, and 99 points for power, and 99 points for dexterity, and because you have no sense of fair play, all of a sudden you've created the Terminator to play wide receiver on your team. Magnus Nilsson is like one of those characters, but for food. He's one of the most respected chefs in the world, and somehow he's also managed to travel to every corner of every Nordic country and wrote not one, but two books documenting recipes for like every single food in every single cuisine he found. And oh yeah, he photographed them all himself too, so hey, that's ridiculous. Anyway, his latest, The Nordic Baking Book, isn't just a cookbook for bakers. It's a dive into what the breads of a place say about the history and climate and economics of a place. Our friend Shauna Seaver talked with him about what he found out.
Hi, Magnus. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, when you first open this beautifully massive book, you're greeted with a map that shows you just how vast the geographical area is that we're talking about here. And it's much more inclusive than, say, a Scandinavian cookbook would be. Scandinavia is more of a cultural term, right? What's the difference between Scandinavian and Nordic?
Scandinavia is actually the three kingdoms, Norway, Denmark, and Sweden, and nothing else. Whilst the Nordic region is Scandinavia plus Finland, Åland, the Faroe Islands, Iceland, and Greenland.
It's huge.
It is.
So I think that distinction is really important, because that must have informed you how to approach the recipes. This book feels almost like a textbook. It's really factual, really well-researched. So you have this huge area that you're covering, so much history, and I imagine so many recipes. How do you even know where to begin?
I mean, so this book project has been spanning over about 6 years. And halfway through it, we produced the Nordic Cookbook. And now to finish it, we have done the Nordic baking book. And it's meant to be sort of a snapshot of what people actually eat and bake in their homes today. Meaning that most of the research was actually done out in the field, meeting people, looking into their homes, reading their recipe books and so on.
You have so many wonderful recipes in the book, and it's such a wide variety of things, and pastries and pancakes and cookies. But I think the breads really shine in this book. And bread seems to be a very important part of Nordic living, a really important part of the menu at Fabeken, certainly. So can you give us some examples of the versatility of bread and how it's eaten in different parts of the region?
I think it has to do with the fact that most of the Nordic region is a marginal climate, and various dishes made from grains used to be a daily staple, and still is for most people, actually. And it used to be where most of your caloric intake came from. And because of this, there is also a huge variety in what kinds of bread we make. And I think that's really reflected in this book as well, even though, I mean, people today, they don't have to eat, the traditional bread of their region to survive anymore, but we still choose to do because we like them.
You set the stage for the book in a way that's really clever. The first section is called The Four Grains of the Nordic Region. And I thought this was a really interesting way to start the book. So what are those four grains and why are they the foundation of Nordic baking?
So, well, there are wheat, barley, oats and rye. And what makes the Nordic region sort of culturally very interesting and diverse when it comes to the baking is that one of these grains has always been, you know, very important in every part of the region. And if you compare that, for example, with a more homogeneous climate, like, say, France, you know, all over France they grow wheat, meaning that wheat is also the predominant ingredient in most French breads and pastries. But wheat only grows in a small part of the Nordic region. And then you have another part, let's say Finland, for example, where rye is, you know, the predominant grain, or up north where I come from, where barley would be the grain of choice in historical times. And things like that really influences what people could bake in the past and what we choose to bake today.
Now let's talk a little bit more about rye, which I think of as being such a classic ingredient and flavor in Nordic baking. And you don't find it all over the place, but you do here. And when and where did rye start to take hold in the story of Nordic cuisine?
I mean, that's something that's actually not been proven. But it's one of the grains that have been there for, you know, since prehistoric times, essentially. You can look, though, today and see where it's been popular for the last, let's say, 300 or 400 years. It would be Finland, as I said before, and also Denmark to a large extent. And for different reasons. I mean, in Denmark, which has the greatest farming climate in all of the Nordics, people grew wheat on their best soils, and wheat was and still is a very, highly prized trade commodity. So that was sold to continental Europe. And then they grew rye on their poorer soils, which they kept for themselves. And this really reflects in what breads you'll find, because in Denmark you'll have both pure wheat breads and you'll have pure rye breads, and you also have a mix of wheat and rye in some breads. Whilst in Finland, that can pretty much only grow rye and not so much wheat because of the climate, with very, very short and dry summers in the south and a bit too much cold in the north for wheat, you'll have almost only pure rye breads.
Rye is lower in gluten than wheat, correct?
Yeah.
So how does this affect the types of breads that are baked, the shapes, the textures? Can you give us some specific examples?
I think that they get flatter the further north you get is actually really interesting. Because like the fluffy wheat loaf, traditionally, you would pretty much only have found in the south, where you incidentally also have the highest density in population, meaning that there was also bakeries there. And the further north or the more marginal the climate, the less wheat people would have access to. And so you would get flatter breads. And the further north you come, you reach a point where pretty much all of the breads were only various types of flat breads, you know, dried crisp flatbreads or soft flatbreads.
One more thing I wanted to ask you about, because in terms of bread baking, slow fermentation has become really popular and sourdoughs. Can you tell us about the relationship between regions that use a lot of rye in their baking and their use of these kinds of methods? There seems to be a connection there.
I mean, there is a connection. And first of all, one thing that we have to think about is that for industrial yeast production, all fermentations were slow fermentations and sourdoughs. In a historic perspective, the kind of recipes we have today with fast fermentations is fairly new, and they're very reliant on the industrial bit. And if you look at the repertoire of recipes you'll have in let's say the Nordic region, then where you'll find most quick fermentations will also be in those areas that I said before, where you had the most wheat. So most of those recipes would be from southern Sweden, Denmark, maybe a little bit in southern Norway and southern Finland. Simply because, if you'd baked for generations and generations and you've done your slow ferments, and all of a sudden someone introduces the yeast, and instead of 3 days, it takes 45 minutes to leaven the loaf. And instead of like a bit fluffy, it gets really fluffy. With wheat, those things are, you can easily see why that was very appealing and therefore also popular. And then you can go to Finland, where almost all of the baking is based on rye. Rye has a different sort of a composition of the starch content than wheat, and it ferments in a different way. And it doesn't really fluff up because it doesn't produce as much gluten. And if you do a quick fermentation of rye, it just doesn't taste particularly good either. It really needs that slow fermentation to break down some of the complex carbohydrates and produce a bit of acidity and so on. So for them, the result was just much less immediately appealing. And in relationship to that, if you also take in consideration that industrial yeast needs to have industries to produce it, if the population is not particularly motivated to use your yeast, you're not going to start a factory there either, right?
Right.
So I think that, and that really shows even today, because Finland has many, many more of the slow fermentations than we have in central Scandinavia.
Well, this is just amazing. Thank you so much for talking about it and creating a book that really is just a peek at a part of the world we really don't get to see often enough. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Magnus Nilsson is the author of the Nordic Baking Book, and he gave us a bunch of his bread recipes, including a really cool one from Sweden for twist bread, and you bake on sticks. You'll totally need it for your next campfire. They're all at splendidtable.org. There is a fine line between being proud and being self-important, and honestly, I don't know which side of the line New York City falls on when it comes to its attitude about its bagels. You still have people screaming halfway across the country about how it's the New York water that makes them so good, that makes them the best. But I'm a New Yorker, and I'm not really sure our bagels are the best. So we're going to talk about them today with one of New York's best bagel bakers at the moment. Her name is Diana Dowhung. She's a Lao Thai woman who quit working in advertising to get into cooking, and the New York bagels she bakes are actually made in her very own style. Hey, Diana, how are you?
I'm doing awesome here.
Yeah.
It's great.
I'm doing more awesome because now you walk in, the scent of these beautiful bagels and their seeds and their garlic is wafting through. So, but I do want to start with the question of the New York bagel. So I grew up in New Jersey, so every bagel I ever had was a New York bagel, but it is a particular style. So stylistically, what is a New York bagel?
Oh, man. I think it's interesting because they've definitely evolved. I'll just talk about what New York bagels are today. So
sure.
New York bagels are this huge, bloated, barely have a hole in it. It looks like just a belly button in a roll, essentially, nowadays. Very lackluster in flavor. You really, especially in bread, you want that awesome fermented, yeasty, almost beer-like flavor. But a lot of bagels that we now know are called New York bagels barely have a taste of fermentation in them. It's probably so far from what they originally started off at, in Poland, essentially. So,
and what was the model that it's since evolved from?
So, there's so many different stories of what it originally started off at, but the stories that I've heard were they really were a biscuit or more of a pretzel-like texture. So super dense, a lot smaller. They were also known as bagel biscuits. So probably a quarter of the size of what a typical New York bagel is, And again, much bigger hole. They used to be, I think a lot of bagel shops still do this, but they used to be on wooden dowels. So the hole actually has to be big enough to go into a wooden dowel. but again, a lot more dense, less fluffy, not so much, for lack of a better word, a roll with a hole in it.
And you brought some. These are from, I guess we don't have to name where they're from, but this is from like a legit bagel bakery.
Yeah.
So let's taste it and let's talk about what these things are in their good form today.
Yeah, absolutely. And these are actually literally, I think, a block away from where we're at now, which is like really close to Grand Central. So the mecca of New York, right, essentially?
Right up.
Yeah, so automatically, like the first thing I taste is what I was saying earlier, just that lack of real bread flavor. Obviously, it still tastes like bread, you know, because you can taste the flour, the salt in it. But again, it's super fluffy. The size is like the first thing you notice, and particularly the hole size. Like this one right here, barely, I don't even call that a hole. That's like a, I don't even know what that is, a crack.
There might be some light coming through that hole, but yeah, the bagel is almost 6 inches wide, five or 6 inches wide. This one's probably like 2.5 inches tall. I mean, I have to say, eating it, it does, I mean, it's tasty. There's a little crispness in the crust.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sweetness.
Mm-hmm.
It's chewy,
mm-hmm.
but it is kind of, it's not a flavor that really lingers.
I mean, I think too, a lot, I mean, I know these guys boil their bagels, but a lot of, you know, new school bagels actually don't even do the boiling process anymore. There's dough conditioners now that will give you that similar quality of getting that shine, changing the texture. I don't think a bagel is a bagel unless it's boiled. I think boiling is like the most important process of bagel baking itself.
What does boiling do?
Boiling does a lot of things. So that shine that you get in bagels, that's part of boiling. But the texture, mainly boiling kind of strips away a lot of the proteins to give you that more chewy texture that you expect.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, if you were just to take a regular bagel and not boil it and not put any dough conditioners in it, it would come out a lot like a roll, essentially. So,
So how did the bagel get from this, you know, intense artisanally made product that had these qualities you're talking about, a big hole, always boiled, a chewiness, a density, a fermented flavor, to the sort of puffy things we see today?
Well, again, I think like anything, there's so many stories behind it. But the one that I heard was, one, the union, you know, a lot of people aren't aware that there was a bagel union that started really early on. I want to say like in the 1930s. And then they developed even greater numbers in like the 1960s.
Mm.
And there's also the story of Lender himself. Mr. Lender was this great business genius. And I think both sides were probably figuring out, like, how do we get more money? And any bread baker knows, you know, if you want to double something, you just let it proof a little bit longer. And the longer you let something proof, the softer it becomes, actually, because it creates more air pockets, more air cells.
Mm.
You know, and that's why it's a lot softer than it was back in the day. And, you know, again, it takes the same amount of labor, just a little bit longer time, same amount of ingredient. So,
and that innovation,
yeah,
so to speak, was attributed to Lender.
Supposedly, that's what I've heard through the grapevine. Yeah.
But there was a story about the bagel union going on strike, too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a couple of times they went on strike. Bagels in particular, back in the day, were really gnarly, gnarly working conditions.
Mm.
There's stories about it where the conditions were just really sweaty because, you know, there's a huge vat of boiling water on top of an oven.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Yeah, so and most bakeries were all in the Lower East Side, all on Delancey and Orchard, in basements. So super low, low ceilings. They would just be paid horribly and working really long hours. So then the union formed, you know, and then, you know, like any union, they were just trying to get better wages, better working conditions.
So when the bagel craftspeople, mm-hmm. when the bakers went on strike, the owners just started mechanizing.
Mechanizing, but also, you know, in order to be a bagel baker, you had to be part of the union. You had to get grandfathered in. You had to be male, be able to speak Yiddish. And again, your father and your father's father had to be a bagel baker.
Mm.
And you'd actually have to train for 6 months before you even got to bake. So once they went on strike, you know, the bakery owners just weren't like, we can't stop business. We're not making that much money where we can just stop for a couple days and that's it. So that's when they started hiring other immigrants, hiring other, you know, obviously you can't tell on radio, but I'm not from a Jewish heritage. You know, I'm Thai Laotian, like you said in the very beginning. So I think it's interesting that back in the day, those people that striked kind of created a whole new interest with other immigrants that weren't Jewish, that weren't from, you know, Eastern Europe, to start making something essentially that was part of their culture. And I think that's how the bagel kind of became New York, just like New York with all these amazing cultures in it. The bagel baking became kind of a symbol for that in a way.
It actually is a much more diverse story. It's not like one single story.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, okay, so now you are a bagel baker.
Yep.
When you were developing your style of bagel, what inspired you? Like, what did you want to get at?
Again, not coming from a Jewish background, and I also grew up in Florida where, you know, they're really not known for their bagels. I definitely did a lot of research. I went to San Francisco. There's an awesome shop called Beauties there. One of the owners, Noah Burnimoff, he is actually from Montreal, and the other owner is from Long Island, Matt, and they're actually both from Jewish backgrounds, so they, you know, were really tied into what kind of bagel we were going to make. Mm. So to them, they're just like, you know what, why do we have to do a Montreal style, or why do we have to do a New York style? Let's come up with our own style, and let's take the best of both worlds, you know. For those that haven't had a Montreal bagel, they're really interesting in texture. They're definitely a little closer to like an old school bagel. They're a lot more dense. They're all wood fired, you know, and I think the things that we wanted to take from the Montreal bagel was definitely that honey water, that sweetness from the honey water, the wood oven, absolutely. But the one thing we didn't necessarily always like is how dense the Montreal bagel is. So we wanted to just create a hybrid between those, take the best of both worlds.
All right, and you have some here. Can we taste some?
Absolutely, please.
So this is,
This is probably like my fifth bagel of the day, seriously.
So this is, wow. There's definitely a lot more heft to it. Mm.
So right away you get like that difference in density, right? And also we do a almost 24-hour proof where you get a little bit more of that fermentation flavor.
Yeah, it's not beery or yeasty,
right?
But there's definitely a lot more depth to the flavor in the dough for sure. It's funny because it's denser. It's not as like crisp and chewy as the other more New York style bagel we tasted, but there's a lot more body to it.
Right.
It's a lot more. Yeah. This feels like a crazy thing to say about a bread, but it almost feels like luxurious on the tongue, right? It's like
as you're probably the nicest thing I've ever heard anybody say about my bagel.
But yeah, as you're eating it, it's like hanging out with you. You know, it's like it's not like oh, you're trying to chew your way through it.
Yeah, totally. And that's kind of exactly what we aim for. Nothing that is specific to New York or nothing that's specific to Montreal, but something that is specific to Black Seed.
Mm-hmm.
So
I'm so glad you brought a dozen of these. Thank you so much, Diana. Yeah,
thank you.
It's great to talk with you.
Absolutely.
Diana Dowhung is the chef, baker, and partner at Black Seed Bagels in New York, and she's a 2-time James Beard Award nominee for Outstanding Baker. Coming up, we get into injera, the national bread of Ethiopia. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, the show for curious cooks and eaters. In a lot of cuisines, bread is always there. It's for mopping up juices, or eating with butter or oil, or, you know, sometimes it's an art form to itself. But I can't think of a single cuisine that puts its bread more front and center than the food of Ethiopia. Meals are served on the bread as a plate. It's called injera, and it's this sour, spongy pancake. And there's this little Ethiopian restaurant I love in Brooklyn called Awash. So we called the owner, Romeo Regali, to see if he'd give us a lesson in making it. Romeo, thanks so much for having us at your restaurant.
It's my pleasure having you guys here.
So I am really excited to be here because I don't know Ethiopian food very well, but I've loved it every time I had it. I love like the intricate spicing. I love all the vegetables, like the amazing spiced puree, lentils and beans. But the thing I always come back to that I'm fascinated by is the bread, the injera. Did I pronounce it right?
Yes, you did pronounce it right. It's
yes.
Injera. Yes, yes.
So the injera, because it is pretty clearly more than quote unquote just bread.
Bread, absolutely.
It has a real role in the cuisine. Tell me about it.
It's not only a bread, it's a culture.
Huh.
You know, to eat pasta you need forks, right? You won't eat pasta with your hands.
I mean, you should see me in my kitchen, but sure.
Right. So pretty much injera is, you know, your utensils.
Yeah.
And not only that, all the dishes you've had in the past, the stews, the sautéed meat, the vegan dishes.
Yeah.
it won't taste the same if you eat it with the regular bread. It's that injera combined with all the dishes that gives it a very distinctive taste.
Oh, that's interesting. So the food is like tuned to the flavor of the injera.
Yes.
Like you need the two to make sense together.
Correct, yes.
Oh, right on.
Yes,
yeah. Because it is a very unique flavor. It's sour. It's clearly a sourdough type of bread, but pretty intensely sour. Not like sharp and biting, but like it has a lot of character.
It is very sour. And the reason why it's sour is because we ferment it. Mm-hmm. There's no way you can make injera without fermenting the batter.
Yeah.
So it has to be fermented for 3 to 4 days, depending on the temperature outside.
Yeah.
So that makes it, that's what makes the injera sour.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that, sourness combined with the other dishes is what makes Ethiopian food taste good. Ethiopians love not only, they can have injera all day without any other stews, just with anything. In Ethiopia, they actually eat pasta with injera.
Oh, cool.
That's how much, huge injera is.
It's a really cool, chewy, almost pancake-like thing. Like you said, you rip pieces of it, and that's your utensil. You take pieces of your meat or your vegetables or whatever you eat together. Let's talk about making it. What's it made of?
It's the original way. First, let me start with the original way.
Yeah.
Because, they're making it in the U.S. or Western countries, in Europe or whatever. But back in Ethiopia, there's only one way to make it, and which is 100% teff. So the same
process.
Grain. It's the smallest grain in the world. Very nutrient. It's packed with iron, protein, and a lot of good stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. They call it superfood now. You can find it in Whole Foods. They actually said it's the new quinoa. That's how good it is, for your health. It helps with a lot of health issues.
Yeah.
It helps you with, losing weight. Mm-hmm. So in Ethiopia, back to, how they make it in Ethiopia. So that's the teff by itself is fermented for 3 to 4 days.
Yeah.
In the U.S., we use baking powder.
Okay.
But in Ethiopia, they don't use baking powder.
Yeah.
They use gesho. That's some kind of hop. I don't think you can find that here.
Yeah.
So that's what they use in Ethiopia.
To give it a little bit of more like puff in the end.
And then to get that bubbly look.
Yeah. Because it's very spongy.
Very spongy.
All these air holes in it.
It won't come out right if you don't use that. And that you use it after you ferment it and it's ready for you to make it. Now, when you, in the U.S., I don't know who is the first person that tried to make it with wheat. It works because teff is very expensive. Mm-hmm. Maybe I would say five years ago, you couldn't find it anywhere. You'd have to export it from Ethiopia.
Oh, yeah.
But now they're growing it in America. I believe it's in Utah. They have a huge farm in Utah. It's
a teff, like
teff farm.
Domestic teff production.
Domestic teff production owned by Americans. So still expensive, though.
Yeah.
Still expensive. So because it's expensive, they mix it with wheat flour. Mm-hmm. So you mix the wheat flour separately by itself, and you mix the teff separately by itself.
So two different batters.
You let it ferment for 3 to 4 days, mm-hmm. and once it's ready, then you mix them together and you add a little bit of baking powder.
Okay.
And then it's ready to go. You can make it.
Oh, right on.
Yeah.
And then is there a difference in the flavor and texture between the 100% teff and the mixture of teff and wheat?
Yes, there's definitely a different texture and taste. Me personally, I don't know, it's because I got used to the wheat and the teff together. Mm-hmm. So not only me, a lot of people prefer the one that's mixed together.
Oh, interesting.
But the injera you find in Ethiopia tastes absolutely different than the 100% teff we make here and the other one. It's super, super, super sour.
Well, let's make some. Let's make some
right.
And taste it together.
So should we start with the 100% teff or should we start
tell
with...
Tell me.
We can start with the wheat and the teff.
Okay, sure.
All right. There you go.
So you have this electric griddle.
Yep.
Big flat
it's pretty
griddle.
Pretty hot. No.
It's definitely warm. Yeah. Like I am definitely feeling it radiate.
Right. So you mix this just a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah. But
so this is a very thin. This is the wheat and teff batter. It's very thin. It looks almost like heavy cream. It's
right.
Not even like pancake batter.
No, it's not. Can't be super thick or it won't come out right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So about like a cup of it.
Yes.
Under this 15-inch griddle.
There you go.
So you cover it with the lid. You need to cook it with the lid?
Yes.
Or is it just to
yes.
speed it up?
Oh, yeah. You you have to cover it with the lid.
Oh, interesting.
Or that bubbly look, you won't get it if you don't cover it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's what gives you that look.
Right on.
So this one, it's ready now. In Ethiopia, they don't use the, you know, skillet we use in the U.S.
Yeah.
Because you can't find, you know, what they have in Ethiopia.
Sure.
It's at least 2 or 3 times bigger than this.
All right.
This looks
like
different.
Yeah. 15-inch
right.
griddle. Already.
This is not made for injera, but, you know, it works perfectly fine.
It's like a crepe pan. This
right.
is like a
crepe pan. Yeah. But in Ethiopia, they specifically make it for that.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
called mitad.
Mitad.
Mitad, yes. Now we can make the...
One with altef?
Altef. So when we make the altef, mm-hmm. we use a different skillet because, you know, some people are, you know, a
really
gluten
serious
intolerant.
Yeah.
So, you know, we don't use the same skillet. So, you know, same process for this one too.
Yeah, the color of the altef version is so different. Like if the wheat and teff looked like a, I don't know, like a malted milk. The teff version, I mean, it looks almost like chocolate ice cream.
Chocolate. I was just going to say that.
Yeah.
Chocolate ice cream. You're right.
Like milk chocolate ice cream.
Right.
Not like dark chocolate.
Right. Yeah.
Still, like chocolatey.
And there are two versions of teff. Oh. There's dark teff and there's white teff.
Okay. All right. So you pour that batter onto mm-hmm. this.
There you go.
Crepe yeah. pan. Pick it up. Twirl it around. Really nice motion in the wrist, I can tell.
Right.
It's really... you can see those bubbles forming. And so you want the cover on to get a little steam in there to make those bubbles a little bigger.
Right, right. There you go.
So oh, wow, it cooks up. This beautiful is color. That's beautiful. Almost like rusty color.
Yeah.
It's like rusty.
See the difference.
Color.
You'll know right away this is teff.
Should we taste these?
Of course.
Do you like how this looks?
Yes. All right.
If you're happy, I'm happy.
So taste both and let me know what you think.
All right.
Yeah.
You taste them with me?
Of course.
Okay. You mean the teff one?
Hmm. Okay. I just had the teff one.
All right. This is...
Mm-hmm. You taste the sourness, right? It just, you know, gave me a little tingly...
A little tingle in the back of your mouth, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Almost tastes like fruit. Cherries and...
Right.
Not
right.
sweet, but like that sort
like,
of...
Right, right.
Sour fruitiness.
Right.
It's chewy, but really tender.
Right.
Let me try the mixed one. Now, this has the wheat in it. You can tell the texture is a little different with the
right,
wheat.
Right, right, right.
It's a little bouncier.
Yes.
A little chewier, a little springier.
Yes.
They're both really good. I like the chewiness of the wheat one, too.
I told you, a lot of people prefer the...
Like the teff wheat blend.
The teff wheat blend.
But either way, it's so complex. I love that sourness. Mm-hmm.
That's what brings the flavor of the dishes out. You know, that helps bring... Like this, you know, the stews, all the dishes we have, is when you eat it with the injera,
mm-hmm.
it gives it, like, I don't know how to explain it, a different taste.
Yeah, and the dishes themselves are not made with a lot of vinegar or lemon.
We use a lot of spices, though, like, you know, the berbere, cardamom.
A lot of beautiful spices.
Oh, yeah.
Toasty.
And we get all the, you know, spices from Ethiopia, so you can't find it here.
Yeah, and you get that beautiful shot of this deep, complex, fermented acidity. That's
right.
Chewy and beautiful with every bite of the injera. This is awesome. Thank you so much,
Romeo. Of course, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Romeo Regali is the owner of Awash Restaurant in Brooklyn, New York. You can find a recipe for 100% teff injera from Jessamine Waldman Rodriguez's book, Hot Bread Kitchen. That's at splendidtable.org. All right, so we've been talking about all these cool breads from around the world, right? But when we asked America's Test Kitchen what they wanted to talk about for this episode, they said white bread. Like, really? But yes, white bread, because their editor, Tucker Shaw, is obsessed with it. So Sally Swift talked with him about the beauty of making white bread at home.
Hey, Tucker, great to have you back.
Hey, Sally, it's good to be here.
So we have been digging into bread all hour, and I am coming to you to kind of make you pick your favorite baby in a way. What is your very favorite bread recipe?
Well, I mean, that's like an impossible question to answer, isn't it? I mean, there's nothing better than bread. But I'm going to go with the basic, the good old-fashioned white sandwich bread, kind of that beautiful white bread that you would, you know, when you slice it, you get the perfect shape for a PBJ or a BLT.
Okay, that's a surprising answer to me. Why do you love that bread so much?
Well, for one thing, I can make it. And I'm not the world's best baker. The recipe that we have for this white bread is so simple. Literally, if you can read, you can make this bread. It takes a little bit of time. But I do it once a week now, and I kind of work it into my, like, Saturday morning chores. like doing laundry and that kind of stuff when you're stuck at the house anyway, you can pull this off with almost no work. So there you go. You have clean clothes and a fresh loaf of bread.
I love that for the week. Okay, so can you talk me through the process?
Sure. It takes 6 ingredients. The most important one here is bread flour, which is really easy to find at the grocery store. It has a slightly higher protein content than all-purpose flour. And you want to use the bread flour because it gives your bread a little bit more structure so that when you slice it for sandwiches, it holds its shape. You take that and you whisk it together with some yeast, just the kind that you get in the little packets that you'll find in the baking section, and a little bit of salt. Whisk those together and, you know, attach it to your stand mixer with the dough hook.
Okay, so those are your dry ingredients, and they're in the bowl in your stand mixer. And then what's the wet that you add?
So the wet ingredients consist of whole milk, a little bit of water just to expand the liquid ingredients, a little bit of butter, maybe just 2 tablespoons that you melt and cool down. You whisk that together with the milk, and the butter adds a little bit of extra fat. And that ensures that the crumb is going to be sort of tender and a little bit rich. And then 2 tablespoons of honey, and you whisk that all together. And the honey gives it a little bit of sweetness and also gives the yeast a little bit something extra to participate
eat.
With.
A little extra to eat. Okay, and then I'm assuming you're kneading it with that dough hook that you've put on your stand mixer?
That's right. You set the stand mixer onto medium-low, and you slowly pour the liquid ingredients into the bowl. And it will start to come together after about, I would say, 1.5 minutes, maybe 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then you let it rip for 8 minutes of kneading, and it will start to come away from the sides of the bowl. It will create kind of a cohesive ball of dough, and it will do the work for you. So you can check your laundry.
And then you go, you put in another load, and then you come back. And you is this where you shape it?
Not yet. You take it now and you put it into a bowl that you've just lightly greased so nothing sticks. Cover it with plastic wrap, put it aside for 1.5 hours, maybe 2 hours. You want it to double in size,
okay.
But that gives you the opportunity. I don't know, you go cut the grass now.
I do love the chore link.
So after it's doubled in size, you turn it out onto a very lightly floured counter, and you just very gently sort of bring it together into a ball, press it down into a rectangle of about 8 inches by 6 inches. And it's a really supple, easy dough to work with. It's not sticky in the least. You can achieve this shape without really working it very hard, and maybe takes, I want to say, 30 seconds, maybe 1 minute.
Huh.
From there, you roll it like a log. And you have to roll it fairly tightly so that you don't get like big air pockets in the bread after it bakes.
And you mean you're rolling it up with your hands, not with the rolling pin?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Rolling it
all
up
right.
Like a jelly roll or something.
Okay,
like that.
Great. That's super easy.
That goes into a loaf pan and you let it rise again for about 1 hour.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll know it's ready when it's about 1 inch above the lip of the loaf pan.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got a kind of a nice dome on top.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, you will have turned on your oven. It'll be at 350 degrees, and so it'll be ready to go. Slide that sucker in the oven. About 35, 40 minutes later, your bread is done. And you will know it's done because it smells so fantastic in your kitchen.
Yeah.
You can check it with an instant read thermometer. If it's at about 205 to 210, that's perfect. But really, if you've just baked it for 35 or 40 minutes, it's going to be just right. You pull it out of the oven and let it cool in the pan for about 10 minutes just to make sure that it's, you know, easy to release and that kind of thing. And then you slip it out of the pan, put it on a wire rack, and let it cool for about 3 hours. And you have to let it cool all the way down before you slice it. Because if you maybe you've experienced this before, when you use a serrated knife on a piece of bread that's too warm, you run the risk of tearing it. And this is sandwich bread, so you want perfect slices. And the way to achieve that is to make sure that it's cooled down and use a really nice serrated knife. We have a favorite serrated knife. It's made by Mercer. It costs about $20. Sometimes I've seen it for about $18. So it's not a big purchase, but it's totally worth having because then you'll get perfect even slices every time you do it.
Yeah, bread knives are an important tool to have in the kitchen.
They're just so useful and there's no substitute for them and they don't cost a lot of money, so you should have one.
Well, it sounds to me like the hardest part of this whole thing is waiting for that loaf to cool.
It really is. I mean, it was astonishing to me the first time I made this bread, how simple it was, because bread has always been sort of mysterious to me, and I've always, like, really admired people who made bread because I thought they had some sort of magical, you know, ability to do something that us mere mortals couldn't pull off. But right. Sandwich bread is so easy, and I literally, Sally, I do it every week.
All right. Long live American bread. Thanks to you, Tucker Shaw.
Thank you, Sally.
Tucker Shaw is editor of America's Test Kitchen, and you can find that recipe for American sandwich bread at splendidtable.org. And that is our show for the week. But until next week, eat well, drink well, and please tip well. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell, Jenny Lupke is our editor and technical director, Erica Romero is our assistant producer, Chip Walton is our digital associate producer, and Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. Talk to you next week. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.